Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 142 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by author, editor, and music journalist Paul DeNoyer. His interviewees have ranged from Madonna to Pavarotti, David Bowie to Mick Jagger, nearly everyone with a strong connection to the Beatles, not least Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. And of course, interviews with Paul Weller, interviews during the Jam, the Style Council, solo periods, in publications such as NME, The Hit Magazine, Mojo, The Word. So his career began on NME. He was in the launch teams of magazines Q, Mojo, Heat and The Word. He edited Q, and he was the founding editor of Mojo magazine as well. This is an absolute corker. Let's get into it. Paul DeNoyer, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
I'm really looking forward to having you on the podcast here because we're going to dig into so many memories, the Jam, the Style Council, Paul Weller solo. We're talking NME, Q Magazine, RIP, Mojo Magazine, and so much more. But let's kick off. I think, much like Mr. Weller, I reckon your love of music starts with the Beatles. Would that be fair?
Yes, that's exactly the case. I was about seven or something, I suppose. And of course, I was living in Liverpool, so I was right in the middle of this pop music revolution, and it was a great it was a great source of excitement to everybody in the school, and everybody knew this band was local. They talked like we did, and they were just the greatest thing. It was the first pop music I ever listened to, as opposed to I'd heard pop music before that. You know, there was, I guess, it was Cliff Richard and Out of Faith and people like that, but the first music that I sat up and paid attention to was those first Beatles singles.
And a lot of people have talked about the Jam being a schoolboy band, and these people then have those connections with the Jam 45 years later because the band existed for their school life. Was that true of you and the Beatles then? Were they like literally your school years were that band?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very fortunate time to have come across them, really, because the very first Beatles songs, they were so straightforward. I mean, I was only a young child, and they were kind of a follow-on from the nursery rhymes I'd listened to a few years before that. You know, they were, I mean, now we all know those Beatles songs. They're not quite as simple as they seem, because they're actually very sophisticated harmonically. There's all kinds of clever stuff going on there. But on the surface, you know, they're easy songs for a seven-year-old child to latch onto. And then as I grew older into adolescence, the Beatles own music was growing much more mysterious, I suppose, enigmatic along the way, which kind of mirrored my maturity into teenage years, I suppose. So I was kind of going along on this journey with them for that 9 or 10 years or whatever it was that it lasted. So it was a very fortuitous time to be growing up, I think, with the Beatles playing in the background.
Now, this connection with that band and particularly Paul McCartney continues, and we'll dig into some of that stories later on, because I'm sure Mr. Weller would love that because he's such a massive McCartney fan, and that influence him so much, particularly the beginning when he was a bass player when the Jam first started out and all that. But let's talk about this move to London. So when you were 18, I think it was, you moved to London, and initially it wasn't about journalism, was it?
No, I always had this idea that I wanted to go down and see London for myself, and the opportunity came when I got a place at the London School of Economics. So I just turned 18 when I came down, and it was just great. You know, I mean, what I was really interested in was the music. The bands would come along to the LSE. I would go down to see bands at the Marquee or wherever. So that was a real thrill. And it was It was just shortly after I left the LSE that I was still in London, not quite sure what I wanted to do, but that was when the NME advertised for new staff writers. I didn't get that job. They gave the job to Julie Birchall and Tony Parsons, actually. This is at 76, the time of punk. But what they said to me was, you know, why don't you stick around? You might be able to do some freelance work for us. So that's what I did. A couple of years after that, 79 or so, they gave me a staff job. So that was really the beginning of my full-time career.
Right, okay. And this was the time Neil Spencer would have been editor at the time. Would that be right?
Neil had just taken over from Nick Logan when I was starting to write. So Neil was the first editor. It was Neil who gave me my job.
Right, okay. And Neil, there's connections with Mr. Weller through, you know, so much, and Red Wedge and all that. But I read the other day, I found a nice little quote from Paul when he was talking about NME. And he said, when I was a kid, the NME was the Bible. In Woking, you got it on a Thursday. I'd rush out, read it cover to cover, even the articles about bands I didn't like. And that's true of so many people with the NME. This weekly newspaper, music newspaper, was people's Bible. It was such an important thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it certainly had been for me when I was growing up, just like Paul. I mean, I'd rush out and get the paper on the Thursday. I'd get the others as well. There was this, the Melody Maker and Sounds and a couple of others. But the NME was the one, that was the main one. It seemed to have the most authority, as well as being having a kind of sense of humour and just a style of its own, which was very attractive to a lot of us. And so obviously, of course, to land a job on this actual paper itself was the dream job for me.
It's funny because even for me, as a teenager in 1991, I was the same. It was, you know, I was buying Melody Maker and NME every week, consuming all the music that was in it and stuff. So that still continued, and it's a shame that's not the situation now. And we'll talk about music press and where it is now, because obviously you've been involved in so many magazines and launches and all that over the years. In terms of Mr. Weller, let's look at the Jam. Obviously, his first iteration. Can you remember when you first saw them?
I can't actually, because at that stage, this is the late '70s, I was going out literally every single night, firstly for my own pleasure, because that's what I wanted to do, and then secondly, it became part of my job, really, to just to keep going out. So I honestly can't remember, but I certainly saw them, and the Damned and the Sex Pistols and the Clash and all those groups, Elvis Costello, everybody who was coming through in that. It was a fantastic period. You know, all these people were brand new, or they seemed brand new, as far as we were, and they all came through within this very compressed space of time, didn't they? Between, you know, the Damned and the Pistols had their first singles out in 76, but by 79, you know, a good 20 or 30 new acts had established themselves, and you know, they're all pretty much household names to this day, including, not least Paul, and through his different career stages.
Wasn't it fantastic when you say that, like, I was out seeing bands every night, that you could do that? They were all the venues and the acts, and a really exciting time for the new music, but for young people, you know, that this was music that was aimed at you.
Yeah, it was. Again, I mean, I felt I was just very lucky to have been in that place at that time. You know, the Pistols I saw at the 100 Club, and that was, I know lots of people say they saw Sex Pistols at the 100 Club. But
Yeah. I think the whole of London was at that
game. I know. But I honestly did. It was just an accident because I was.
I've got the lie detector on. You know that, right?
One night I was going to, there was a band called Rugalator, who were more of a pub rock than punk rock kind of group. They were very good, but they were due to play the 100 Club. So I went out to see them, and lo and behold, they'd cancelled. And at first I thought, I'd heard of the Sex Pistols. Neil Spencer actually had done a review of them in the NME. So I thought, okay, well, I'll stick around, you know, I've got nothing to lose. So I did see the Sex Pistols. The audience wasn't punk. The audience was mostly, I got the impression the audience were mainly Scandinavian tourists. It was the middle of summer. There wasn't really a punk rock movement at that point in 1976. Developed a bit later. But of course, the Pistols were extraordinary, and I went back and saw them again a few weeks later. And so I suppose I was just attracted to them for all the reasons that that Paul was, I guess. He was just a little bit younger than me. And of course, he was an accomplished musician. I was never a musician, never had ambitions in that direction. I just wanted to write. But the impact of the Sex Pistols, above all, was just, it was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of experience.
In doing research for this show, there was a line I came across from you, where you were talking about the song In the City. So this is the Jam's debut single. And this was in a book that you were writing a little while back now, which was all about London and music and the connections. And you said about the In the City that it was all the pent up sense of possibility that London can present to the energetic incomer compressed inside 2 minutes, 20 seconds. And I was like, I love that line. That's really nice. Sums it up perfectly. But the power of that first single, I mean, it's an incredible first single, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So I call the book In the City. It's a kind of little homage to Paul and the Jam. And something I did find I had in common with him in a way was that even though he's from Southeast, he felt like he wasn't a Londoner. He felt like he was just as I did. I mean, I was coming from, you know, from up north and 200 miles away. And I really took to London. It really excited me. It lived up to all of my expectations. And it was funny that Paul went through a similar kind of experience. For him, London was a faraway place. It was nothing like Woking. And for him, it was full of possibilities. And he, just like I did, you know, he dreamed of going there one day and making it his home. And of course, I think he still lives in the city even to this day. So we both, that's something we talk about over the years, really, this, you know, this excitement that we still felt about London and the possibilities that it always seemed to offer.
There are many connections with Paul that we'll dig into that with some good stories of life on the road, right? So let's talk about that first interview with the Jam. Can you remember when you first connected with Paul and met up with him and interviewed
him?
Yeah,
I'm not positive. I'm not sure when I first met him. He did come into the NME office quite a lot. The first time I interviewed him anyway, I was sent on the road with the Jam. They were playing a music festival in Finland, big outdoor festival somewhere. So I spent a couple of days with him and got to know him and, you know, and the other guys in the band, and John Weller and Kenny Wheeler, all these people that you will know very well. I hung around with that. Petty Smith was my photographer from the NME. He was also very close. She was very close to Weller and the Jam, took lots and lots of pictures of them, you know, for their own purposes as well as for editorial assignments. That was a really fascinating, great to spend some time with them. I liked Paul very much on a personal level. He was just a bit of a bugger about doing interviews. You know, he was like this for years after. He's not like that now, I don't think. But he's happy to talk. He's not like he was a recluse or anything. He wasn't standoffish or surly. He was pretty friendly. We got on pretty well. They just didn't want me to sit down and turn on that tape recorder and do a formal interview. You know, he was quite phobic about doing interviews. And he kept putting it off and off and off. And we finally got some done at the last minute. I don't think it was a brilliant interview, but it was great. It was just a great experience for me.
I read somewhere that this is the tour where this is the first time that you saw a woman take her clothes off for money. Is that right? Can we talk about this?
If we must.
I tell you what, though, it gives you a good insight into Paul and his relationship with Jill and the band and all that at the time as well. So,
it was just a bizarre thing. It was the hotel that we were all staying in provincial town in Finland somewhere. People were having the dinner and having drinks, and then the lights went down and a stripper came on. And I thought, this is strange. You know, we had funny ideas about Scandinavia in England in those days. You know, I thought, this must be what people do in Scandinavia.
Just the evening entertainment, yeah.
And it was just really bizarre. And
wasn't it the theme tune to Clockwork Orange as well? Is that right?
That's right. There's this really icy, chilly synth music by Wendy Carlos. It's a really spine-chilling piece of music, and she was doing this slow routine to this, you know, the least appropriate kind of music. And the thing of Paul is that he was a very he was quite a serious young man at that point. I suppose I probably was as well, but he didn't like this turn of events at all. He was sitting there with Jill, and they just looked at each other and shook their heads, and they got up and walked out. I think I probably stayed, but
yeah, I bet Kenny and John
was enjoying the novelty.
Around,
yeah. I was enjoying the sheer strangeness and the novelty of the whole thing. Then Paul didn't approve of it at all, and quite right, I suppose.
Fair enough, yeah. Now, obviously, the Jam become huge. We're talking number one singles, number one albums, all that as well. And it'll be good to talk about that progression from In the City through to the band that they became and the legacy that there is now. Because you interviewed them many times. You wrote reviews, and there's a wonderful review I found of Sound Effects where you wrote that that album was a brave departure and an earnest effort to break new ground. You said Sound Effects is the Jam today, and that's what we need most of all. There's new songs represent a band that's as vital and as capable of anger as ever. whilst they may not put themselves in the punk camp, they never lost that kind of punk sensibility, that punk ethos, I guess.
One of the things I really liked about the Jam in the early days was that they'd taken what seemed to me the important thing about punk whilst preserving their own identity. They weren't just another identikit punk group trying to sound like the Sex Pistols and trying to dress like the Clash or whatever. You know, the Jam had their own vision of things, but what they took from punk was that impatience and that urgency, love of getting your point across as quickly as possible and then getting out and onto the next thing. And I admired that in the band. And that's right. I remember now that the time that I did go on the road with them, they were about to, they were finishing off the Sound Effect album. Right. That's right. Start was the single at the time. And Paul was clearly going into a kind of 1966 phase in his head. You know, he was wearing, silk cravat, very lovely 60s dark suit. I always admired his dress sense. I mean, I thought he was so brilliant at that. But it was clear from hearing the demo, the early tracks for Sound Effects, it was clear that he was really pushing against the boundaries of what he'd achieved with the Jam previously. And I guess with hindsight, it wasn't too much of a surprise that he wanted to break out of the Jam as he did a couple of years after that. So I wasn't entirely surprised, but I admired his bravery in doing so. I mean, imagine walking away from a band like the Jam, who were at the absolute peak of their success. You know, the bottle it requires to make a career decision like that. But he's had that all along. One of the things I rate him so highly for is he had that bravery that the Beatles had and Bowie had and Dylan has had. I mean, these people will always drop everything that they're known for, everything that their success has been based upon. They'll simply drop it and do something utterly new the next time, as if they're willing to risk everything, you know, alienate all their fans. And of course, those people with the Beatles would always get away with it. Bowie didn't always get away with it. Dylan doesn't always get away with it. And I guess you could say that Paul didn't entirely get away with it all the time. You know, it was very hard to keep up with Paul. And it was only to be expected, I suppose, that with each twist and turn that he took creatively, he wasn't going to bring everybody along with him. Not everybody could stay on board. He hasn't done too bad, has he?
No, that's true. I was thinking the other day, actually, how what must he have been going through his head the morning of that announcement? You know, the morning of him telling his dad or telling the band. Me, I'd be like, no, just you could have bottled it, right? It's such a huge, momentous decision to make. But obviously, he went, you know, went that way. But yeah, I wonder what was going through his head the morning of, and or was he just kind of, you know, this is the right decision, we've done it, or were there nerves, was there doubt? I don't know. I can't wait to have a conversation about it. But the Style Council, obviously, you know, when we're talking about Chameleon and the kind of changing moods and the changing styles and all that, I mean, the Style Council were very much that band. And you were there along that journey as well. You interviewed Paul during that time too.
I did, yeah. This time I was working for a short-lived magazine called The Hit, and for the launch, Paul had done a cover session, photo session of himself as a boxer.
Oh, right. I'm not saying that. Okay.
You haven't seen it?
No, I've not seen that.
I must send you it. He's got all these kind of Lonsdale. I mean, of course, he looks immaculate. He's got all these Lonsdale pieces of kit on him and gloves and things. And I'm not sure what the purpose of that was, but it made for a good. Anyway, they sent me over to Australia. That's right. He and the Style Council had just done some dates in Japan, and now they're in Melbourne waiting for their equipment to be sent on to Australia for that leg of the tour. And spent about a week with them. And once again, you know, it was nice to hang around with Paul and deal with Mick was great, and Steve White, very easy people to get along with. You know, it was very pleasant, except it was a very unhappy time because he was out there with Jill Price, who I also knew quite well, I suppose, in those days. But their relationship was coming to the end, and simultaneously his relationship with DC Lee, who was now in the lineup of the Style Council, was coming together, you know, and there was an awkward overlap. And it was uncomfortable to be around because the atmosphere within the camp around the band was, I think, very tense, actually very subdued. It was just an awkward time emotionally for him. And but anyway, we did a Paul being Paul, he was always putting off the interview. And I mean, we were scheduled to, that's right, they planned a kind of promotional exercise. We were in Melbourne, and then they were going to go on to Sydney, and they arranged to hire some carriages of train rather than just flying up to from Melbourne, Sydney, which anybody else would do. The Star Council decided we'll hire part of a train and we'll, you know, get the press along, the TV stations, we'll set up some equipment, we'll have jam sessions and all of that. So and it took 13 hours, this main journey. I kept saying, Paul, this is great, you know, but you know, when we get to Sydney, I go home and, you know, we've got to do this interview. You know, I've come all this way. And in the end, he did it very begrudgingly. And it wasn't, again, it wasn't a brilliant interview, but we got it done anyway. And it, astonishing experience to see the Star Council playing. It was like, it's actually like a scene in Hard Day's Night, you know, the Beatles film, where they're traveling in a train carriage and that music kicks in. It was maybe that was part of Paul's thinking at that time. The Style Council were great. They were pretty much at the peak, I suppose, at that stage. Was it just after Our Favourite Shop?
Yeah, it would have been around that time. And Paul hasn't been to Australia very often. So it was, you know, if you're a Weller fan, it's not like you're getting to see him on every tour, is it? So, and I think that was the only time the Style Council played Australia, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, probably was. As I say, there was some kind of personal tension going on in Paul's private life. But in career terms, the Style Council had just about won everybody over, I think, at that stage. It wasn't the last. I mean, the career did sort of tail off a little bit thereafter. But at that point, I thought they were just firing on all cylinders, really.
Tell me about the argument you had with Paul around that time. Can you remember?
Did I?
I read that he apologized to you for an argument that you were, I think you said you apparently had. Not, I don't think you can remember it, but it was something about you recommending country music.
Oh, yes, I remember that. I don't know if it was an argument, really. Paul is, as you know, he can be very, very intense, you know, on the subject of music, particularly in those days when he was very young. And for some reason, I just started to get interested in country music. I'd grown up with country in the background. A lot of my dad's generation in Liverpool, those working class guys all love Johnny Cash and Hank Williams, that kind of thing. You know, Liverpool Dockers, they always love country music. So I thought, well, I've got to take it seriously. I've got to listen to it. And I started to get into country music. I met Paul, actually. I just bumped into him on a tube on the Victoria line, and we're chatting about what we're listening to. He was disgusted that I was listening to country music. I said, no, you've got to take it. See, it's like, it's got everything the blues music has got. It's just a, different flavor. He said, no, he just wasn't having it. You know how he was in those days, absolutely black and white in his views, very dogmatic. But, later on, I mean, he was laughing about it later on, saying, if I didn't like something, I really, really didn't like it. And I wasn't going to give it the time of day. But that's where he stood with country music in those days.
But you're right. I mean, that, compared to some of the journalists and some of the critics that he went for, that is quite light if we're talking about arguments, right? Some of them were much more extreme than that.
Oh, yeah, there was no, I don't remember having any kind of personal problem with it at any stage.
One thing that's come up quite a bit on the podcast is the culture of the bands. And I know that Paul has knocked the booze on the head in recent years, but some of these times with the Jam or the Style Council, Mr. Weller, were pretty boozy affairs, right? And we'll talk about, I want to talk about Mojo and Q Magazine in a second, but there was this wonderful bit where Paul, and I think emotionally again, maybe wasn't a great time because he'd just done the Covers album. He was kind of trying to find his feet again as a songwriter. He wasn't overly happy with Illumination and Heliocentric, but you joined up with him in Amsterdam for what sounds like the booziest thing I've ever heard. I think you said that it was almost a test that he'd put to journalists that year to just try to, like, just drinking constantly, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. This was 2005. He was in Amsterdam. He was remixing
As Is Now, wasn't it?
Yeah. He'd just finished From the Floorboards Up. He was playing that to me. And I gathered from other journalists who'd met him around that same time, he did this with everybody. It was as if he was putting you to a test. I mean, I do like a drink, but I'd never drunk as much as I did on that day and evening and night. And I don't know how I ever got back, found my way back to the hotel. How did I get back without falling into a canal? What I do remember is waking up the next day, fully dressed. I just must have just collapsed on the bed, and had to just about caught the plane back again. But yeah, he did like a drink in those days. We both drank far too much and probably talked astonishing amount of rubbish.
When did you record the interview? Was it? Well, presumably it was before you went on the bar.
Luckily this time he was far easier about doing interviews. And so we got that out the way at an early stage when we could both string sentences together.
Now, when was it that you joined Q Magazine? So it was from right from day one, yeah?
Yeah, I was on the NME until 85. And then I mentioned this magazine called The Hit, which I was in late 85. It only lasted for about nine weekly issues. But the day that that closed down, I got a phone call from Mark Ellen, who I'd known for years. He was the editor of Smash Hits at that point. And he said, oh, come over and see us because we're thinking of a new idea for a magazine. I went over and saw him and David Hepworth at a publishing company called EMA. And they told me about this idea for a new monthly rock magazine, which became Q. So I joined them as the deputy editor or something and was there in 7 years. I became the editor of Q after Mark had done the first few years. Did that for about 6 or 7 years. It was while I was there that I kind of devised the idea for what I'd like to do next. And I took that to the company and suggested that we start another monthly, which would be called Mojo. They liked the Mojo idea. So I launched Mojo, which I'm glad to learn became a big favourite of Paul's as well.
Yeah, and he's done so much. In fact, he was guest editor in recent years as well, wasn't he? But,
yeah.
And what was the difference? What was the ethos of Mojo that was different to Q then?
Q's job really was to cover, I guess, the albums market. It was a monthly, so it couldn't really be news-driven the way that a weekly music paper was newsy. You can't do that on a monthly because of the lead times and so forth. But what we could do was interview people in depth, and we tended to focus on the big-selling album acts of the day. The contemporary acts at that time would have been U2 and REM and Madonna, Springsteen. If you could get any of these people to do an interview, stick them on the cover, that issue would sell very, very well. And that was fine, but I felt a bit locked inside the mainstream of always having to cover the album charts. And I thought more and more people, I think, are getting interested in reissued stuff. The CD box set was coming into its own at that stage. And I thought, I think people are a lot more curious. They want to know what's going on outside of the charts. They want to know what music used to be around and is now becoming available again. And also what smaller kinds of acts are possibly going to be the big acts of the future. So Mojo always had this double approach of covering old music, but covering new underground music as well.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
All right, so it was all like almost that fanzine mentality of
yeah, that's right. I did say I'd like something that had the production values of Vogue magazine, but the mentality of a fanzine. So I tried to combine those two things, those two qualities.
And obviously, sadly, Q magazine's no longer here. The summer of 2020, off the back of COVID, I think was what killed it off. But I still miss that magazine not coming through my letterbox every month. It was a fabulous publication.
Yeah, it was a shame. I hadn't been working for them for a long time. In the 2000s, Mark Ellen and David Hepworth started up another magazine called The Word, and I did a lot of work for them, including that my infamous trip to Amsterdam with that was done for The Word magazine, which that was very good as well, and that too bit the dust. The climate, the whole commercial climate became very, very tough for those kinds of magazines. The internet did a lot of damage. Advertising dropped away dramatically, but Mojo is still going strong as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, Mojo's a great, Mojo's a great read, a fabulous read. So as founding editor of Mojo, 1993, it launches right at the time that Paul's back. I don't know how much connection you have with him in the Q days, but Mojo, I remember getting, there was a cover, it was June 1995. And I honestly remember getting this magazine like it was yesterday. And you had Paul in this really cool suit on the cover, this red guitar. I mean, like you say, absolutely cool as you like, wasn't it? And this would have been around the time of the release of Stanley Road. So he's properly back on top, huge. You have this beautiful, lovely conversation where you're just talking about music.
Yes, I remember that very well. I'd just heard Stanley Road. It was about to come out, I think. I've said to him once or twice, I think I'm a lucky omen for him because whenever they send me along to do an interview, he seems to come up with another career highlight. Sound effects was an absolute career highlight, I believe. Our favourite shot was the Style Council thing of the moment when I saw them, when I met them, and then Stanley Rhode, you know, real, the absolute breakthrough for him in his solo career. I absolutely love that album to this day. And he looked great. We met in the studio, Noma Studios, I think, in West London, and just one of those interviews that sometimes they're a real pleasure to do, you know, sometimes they're not, but Paul was a lot more relaxed about where he was up to with his career and very happy to do the interview, which helps. Got along good. I was always pleased with that interview.
Yeah, he seemed very open at that time, was willing to talk about the split of the Jam. He was willing to talk about the, you know, the political side of the Style Council and how maybe that turned people off. He was able to talk about, you know, how the Style Council was successful overseas, but the Jam weren't. All that stuff, which you hadn't heard him talk about at all, really. He definitely opened up in that interview.
Yes, I think enough, what year was it, 1995? I think sufficient time had elapsed for him to develop some perspective about his earlier career with the Jam, the Style Council. And also, you know, through the strength of records like Wildwood and Stanley Rhode, he really was establishing himself as a proper solo artist. You know, it's reminiscent, it's strongly reminiscent of the individual Beatles in the 1970s. It was murder for them, you know, having been in the Beatles, to try and get people to take them seriously as solo artists. You know, they were constantly having to fend off questions about the Beatles getting back together and tell us about the good old days, you know, and whereas they simply wanted to get on with the leading the present day lives and making their own music. It was tough. McCartney, who I got to know through interviewing him very regularly, I could see this development in him. This is what happened with Paul. You know, he finally reached a stage where it took until the late 80s, but he finally reached a stage where he felt relaxed enough about the legacy of the Beatles to start playing a lot more Beatles music within his set. I think he realized he'd gained acceptance, he'd gained recognition as Paul McCartney, the solo.
Right. But it took that long. So that would have been what, up to when, like Flowers in the Dirt or something like that?
Exactly. It was Flowers in the Dirt. That was when he was going to do a big world tour, and he hadn't played live for about 10 years at that stage. The last time he tried to play live, he got busted in Japan. That was the end of the wings.
Right.
But by 89, I think he was just a lot more confident about who he was and going out on tour. He was now going to play very long sets. You know how long these sets he does these days, if you saw him at Glastonbury.
Yeah, incredible.
But he'll put in loads and loads of Beatles songs because he knows that that's what people like and they're his songs. He's got nothing to be embarrassed about, you know. He can strike a balance between his own post-Beatles stuff and Beatles stuff, and he's quite happy with that. And everybody else is obviously more than happy to hear him play. And in interviews as well, he'll talk about the Beatles. He'll talk about John Lennon, surprisingly, which he was very reluctant to do for a long time. I guess Paul went through a similar trajectory as well in his life.
Yeah, and it was interesting, actually, that Mojo interview where he was talking about the fact that, you know, from an industry point of view, he was all washed up. You know, he was touting around these demos and nobody's biting. I mean, you think about it, I mean, it's ridiculous now. What are we on, like 30 years of a solo career and the highs that he's had and the, you know, even in just recent years, the incredible albums and the output. But the fact that at the end of the Style Council, the perception was that as what, a 30-year-old man, he was done.
Yeah. It must have been a very tough time. I mean, I can, thinking back, there was quite a gap in my meetings with Paul or my interviews with Paul. And I suppose that would have coincided with him going off the boil commercially. That's right, because I was at Q magazine. Q was quite a commercial kind of magazine. Mm. And if you weren't in the album charts, and Paul wasn't in the album charts at that stage for quite a while, then Q magazine wouldn't have been that interested in you, I think. Mojo was a lot more, I think, I wanted Mojo to be a lot more kind of broad-minded and that, you know, we're not stuck with the mainstream all the while. If people are doing interesting things, then Mojo will find time to meet them. But yes, Paul did have a period in the semi-wilderness, really.
Let's talk about Amsterdam. So we've covered off the bar crawl. One of the things that I found really interesting with this album was around this time. So this is still them working in a very analog way. Everything was all tape. We hadn't yet embraced things like Pro Tools and digital and that. And he talks in the interview, I don't know if you can remember, but he talks in the interview about the fact that he was like a proper tech Luddite.
That's right. In those days, I used to record interviews on my iPod. You would stick a little microphone attachment into the iPod called an iTalk, and it worked very, very well. Paul kept peering at this thing, saying, "And what is that actually recording? And what? And it plays music as well." I don't know how much he was putting on this fogey act because it gave him, because it amused him to do so. I'm sure there was. You can't be a recording musician for as long as he had been, even in analog studios. You can't be that much of a Luddite. You know, you've got to understand how recording equipment works and so forth. But he does like to play that part, doesn't he, sometimes in interviews?
Yeah. Well, he talks about the internet being the devil's window.
Yeah. That's right. Yes.
And he would never have it in his house.
Yes. He was very suspicious of the internet. And I think to this day, and he's not alone in this, I think he's very skeptical about Spotify as well. But that's possibly for the, you know, the financial aspects of Spotify are controversial on their amongst musicians.
Yeah, absolutely. And understandably so, right? Yeah. There was a quote about the iPod where he said it's like a mini fridge with no fucking beers in it.
Yes, well, that tells you a lot about the two things on Paul's mind at that time, you know, mini bars full of beer and suspicion of new recording technology. So that quote sums up both of those aspects, I guess.
You talked about McCartney, and obviously there are so many highlights from you, and such a close connection where you were working really close with him, writing tour programs, all kinds of stuff, and all these conversations which you've collected together in a book in recent years as well. But one thing I wanted to talk about Mojo was David Bowie. This happened when you were editor as well, and didn't you get Bowie for like one whole month to be editor of Mojo magazine with you?
Yeah, Mojo has occasionally had guest editors. Paul Weller did it not so long ago. I can't remember who else we had, but Bowie did it 1 year. I'd left the magazine by that time, but I was still writing for them, and I interviewed Bowie. I interviewed Bowie quite a lot, probably as often as I interviewed Weller, all in all. But yes, we did get him to guest edit, and I think he found it quite frustrating. I think musicians get a bit of a shock because they learn for the first time that's not easy. editing magazines, it's really, really difficult, you know. But then, you know, I'm sure it's very difficult to make albums as great as Paul Weller makes as well. So, you know, we each have our specialisms.
Yeah, but you've got a proper hard deadline, right? It's not like that scope can't creep, right? It's like, you know, you've got your release date that's coming out then, and you've everything is around the clock to make that happen, isn't it?
Printer's deadlines are absolutely immovable. No, there's no way around them. Whereas an album, it can always go back a month, you know, it's not the end of the world, you know. Ideally, you want it out there for the time that you go on tour, et cetera, but the pressures of print world, I mean, the enemy was the worst because that was a weekly. I mean, obviously daily papers have got it even harder, but they tend to have very, very big staffs. Yeah. The enemy was only 5-6 people who were mostly stoned out of the I wasn't.
You're right. It was a miracle that they managed to produce what they did.
It was, because you were never more than 5 days away from the next press day. You know, five working days from the next press day. So it's a miracle that the enemy always.
Because you got to find the time to do the interviews, to write the articles, to go to the gigs that you're going to every night, where you're having a great time and living your life and all that as well.
There is that, and built in is the problem that you are dealing with pop stars who are not. You know, as a species, they're not the world's most disciplined. They're not the world's most time conscious or punctual. They're not always the most cooperative. So you are herding cats throughout the press day, throughout the cycle of the production of the magazine. So it's with a huge sigh of relief that you finally sign it off one night at the Colour House and think, thank God, and now we've only got
there you go again.
All over again. Yeah.
I've asked this question of a few of my guests, and I'll ask of you because you've had these connections with so many huge stars that we've talked about, people like McCartney and Bowie and Bono, whatever, right, and Weller. What is it that they have in common? What is it that makes them have that real true star quality, do you think? Why do they stand out when others don't?
The people you mentioned and plenty of others as well, they've got this talent, this, you know, this God-given talent or wherever it comes from, without which they wouldn't be, we wouldn't be talking about them. But what they bring to the table themselves, I think, is self-belief. They have to take all kinds of setbacks, you know, in the early career. They nearly all went through periods of being ignored and rejected before they get the big record deal and so on. But something in them compels them to just keep going back for one more try, you know, keep knocking on doors. I would find it, you know, I'm not in this position, but it must be terrifying to have written a great hit single or done a great album and then to realize that you've now got to do it all over again. It's not going to sustain you for the rest of your life. Well, I mean, some people do have to settle for trading on one big hit or something, but that wouldn't be enough for somebody like Weller or McCartney or Bowie. You know, they've for their self-respect, I think, demands that they press ahead and they forge something new. It's an unenviable kind of pressure to have to live with.
And Paul's talks about it almost being like this is just his job. It's like what he does. And is that true of people like McCartney and that as well, do you think, where it's just like, regardless, because there will be peaks and troughs in a career. There's great works and there's works that haven't maybe connected and whatever, but ultimately they all seem to be doing it for themselves. And if people follow them on that journey, then great. It is their day-to-day job. They see it that way.
Yeah, and you can see it in the way that they keep going long after they need to, you know, financially. And I don't know how true this is of Paul, but it's certainly obviously true of somebody like McCartney, that he could have given up. He could have retired. He could have retired in 1970, actually, and just lived the high life, you know, on the strength of his royalties. But he was never content to do that. And even now, he's in his 80s, and he keeps going. It's an interesting parallel, isn't it? You know, they are both Weller and McCartney, the two Pauls. They're both so incredibly prolific. There's no slacking in their work rate, you know. That recent glut of Paul Weller albums and how good they were, you know, there was no falling off in the quality at all. I'm tremendously impressed by that. That must be driven by self-belief and, as you say, that sense that it's their job, and if they're not doing the job, what's their life really about? You know, I think McCartney says this quite explicitly. He just wouldn't know what else to do. He wouldn't know what to do with himself. He wasn't writing another song each day and planning another tour or setting up album sessions. It's what he does, and he can't imagine not doing it.
And it's interesting because Paul's talks himself about like almost following the McCartney model. It's back to the Beatles, where even to him, like when he was releasing singles that weren't on albums, that was all the Beatles. You get a feeling where maybe wrapping up the Jam was the length of time of the Beatles. And you get a sense of, well, McCartney's still doing it and he's still gigging. He's still doing new albums. He's still doing new material and all that. That's the model that I'm following, you know?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think most of us think of the Jam as being a very short lived phenomenon, but, you know, they had a long pre-career, didn't they? They were kicking around for quite a long time before they became the Jam that we knew of. So in that sense, they probably did have a lifespan roughly equivalent to the Beatles, I guess. Roughly, anyway.
After 2005, did you have any other connections with Mr. Weller since? Or did you go, do you know what? My liver can't cope.
My liver couldn't cope. I've never drunk anything like that amount, and I wouldn't.
not before and not since.
No, I haven't. And Paul, I think, has sworn off the booze, as far as I'm aware. I don't know whether I've even met him since then, because I stepped back from journalism a couple of years ago now. I'm basically retired now. But I still listen to music, of course. I certainly listen to Paul's stuff, and I'm still as deeply impressed by it as I ever have been. But I don't think I've met him since 2005.
There were a couple of other little connections where... So one of the things I've loved as well is like the liner notes that you write on albums too. And The Master Plan, the Oasis, is one of my favourite outputs from them. I don't, you know, the B-sides and all that we had. But there's also a little Weller connection, right? I thought you might appreciate this. So a band called Doll by Doll.
Jackie Leaven.
Yeah, well, Helen Turner is the connection. So Helen Turner, who might have been on the Style Council tour when you were in Australia. I can't remember if she was part of the band then. I'm not sure.
I don't believe she was.
Okay, but she obviously was part of the Style Council, also part of Weller's solo band. Nice little connection. Helen Turner was on in that band in one of those albums on the reissues that you wrote liner notes for as well. Doll by Doll, what was special about them from your angle?
It was this one guy, Jackie Leaven, who was a big, burly Scottish guy, very poetic speaker. He was just a very impressive character in every respect. I'd met him, I was at the Enemy, and he had this group called Doll by Doll, who were very fierce. They were kind of psychedelic, so they didn't fit the time. They were as aggressive as any punk band you could mention, but the musical palette was broader, and they were a bit older than the punk people. Actually, they were about the same age, but they weren't pretending to be as young as some punk people. Jackie was very much his own man, and he was also very druggy, which made him tricky to deal with. But he gave all that up, actually became very active in drug addiction charities and so forth. And then he had a very long career as a solo artist, produced a wealth of phenomenally great music. He sadly passed away just a couple of years ago, but he was somebody I kept in touch with throughout, which is probably how I got to do those sleeve notes for his reissues. Yeah, he was a lovely guy. I miss him a lot.
You mentioned retirement from music journalism, writing for the magazines, newspapers, that kind of thing. But in terms of books, are you done now? Is that it? Are we?
I don't know. I might write another book. I could do that if an idea occurs to me that I'm sufficiently enthused by, because books also are actually much harder work than they look, as I discovered to my dismay when I first, I've done about 6 or 7 books now. You've got to really, really enjoy the subject, you know, because you're stuck with the subject for 2 years or something, almost to the exclusion of being able to think about anything else. One of the great things about journalism is that you can't get too bored by anything, because you're always on to the next thing. You know, you might work on a big feature for a week or something, but that's as long as you ever spend on one thing. Then you're on to something else. So you've got this constant variety. It's kaleidoscopic. That was good. I still do stuff for people, sub-editing, editorial consultancy and things. Most recently I did, McCartney had this big 2-volume book called Lyrics.
I've got it here. Oh my God, what an amazing piece of work that is. God.
Yeah. Well, I had to read it about 5 times in quick succession to look for factual errors and typos and all that kind of thing. It was actually during lockdown, come to think of it. It was a very nice way to spend lockdown, you know, immersed in the memory of Paul McCartney and having to gently point out bits where his memory wasn't functioning, but absolutely perfectly. But it does, I say that, and there are very few. Life is packed with incidents as his has been. You can be forgiven for getting a couple of dates mixed up along the way.
Yeah. But actually, the amount of memories that are there, I mean, you think as well, that must have been absolute chaos at points where you talk Beatlemania. Half the time, we won't even know where they were. Surely they're being whisked around from here to everywhere, you know?
Yes, absolutely. I often found that with him, and he would remember lots of incidents, but he didn't have a timeline for them. His memories are like Polaroids that he's thrown into a big suitcase. They're all just jumbled up inside this suitcase. And he can open it up and pick out a Polaroid and look at it, and he can tell you a story about that. But he relies on other people, you know, like me or Mark Lewison, to assemble it all and put it all into shape.
Love it. I love it. Hey, look, man, this has been so lovely chatting with you, Paul. I've really enjoyed it. I've got 2 final questions for you before you go, okay? So you are allowed 1 Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, your face, The Style Council, or Paul Weller solo. Just the one. What are you going
to
go with?
Okay. Well, there's one that does mean a lot to me, actually. I know we'll do it to a lot of people. It's called You're the Best Thing. The reason is it came out in 1984 when my wife and I had our first child, our eldest son. And this song was, you know, on repeat on the radio at that point. And so the two things fused in my mind, this baby, our first baby, and You're the Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me, playing on the radio. And so that's corny as it sounds. That would be my pick.
I'm welling up, man. I'm welling up. Oh, how lovely. Final question. Okay, so the purpose of this podcast, Paul, is to hear stories from people like yourself who had these connections with Mr. Weller, The Jam, The Style Council, solo. Hear your stories. But I've got to be honest, really, the point of the podcast is for me to get to interview Paul Weller. It's something I never managed when I was a radio presenter. And I gave up that career over 10 years ago. And that was my one big regret, never getting to interview Paul. Obviously, you've done it on many, many occasions, right? So you'll have bits of advice for me, I'm sure, if this happens. But I've literally created a podcast and we're now into,
is this year number 3? This is year number 3 of this thing, right?
To get an interview with Paul Weller. That's the sole purpose of this thing, right? So if it happens, Paul, what should I ask him? And also, any advice?
I don't know. He's not, in the old days, it was quite simple. You know, you each had a pint of beer in your hand and you sort of took it from there. Of course, he doesn't do things that way. Does he still smoke?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's the one vice that he's not got rid of.
Such an intensive smoker. I probably smoked when I first met him in the very early days.
I feel like it's the kind of thing also where you feel like you have to smoke if you're with him, probably, right? Even for the podcast, I'd be like, I'm going to have a cigarette because this is, otherwise, how are we going to get a connection?
You know? I don't know. If I did him again, maybe I'd start up again. I don't know. But I think getting an interview with him is not easy, I guess, nowadays. But if he's decided to do it, I mean, he's a lot more relaxed about, you know, if he's decided he wants to do an interview, then he's got to go there and he's got to talk, you know, he's got to make it a pleasant sociable occasion, I think. That's the impression I get when I read his interviews these days.
And that wasn't always the case, like you say. No, so if you're thinking about 95, 2005, much, much easier than the Jam days, the Style Council days, right?
Absolutely, yes. He was very, very suspicious. And I think he thought it was all a game that was being framed, rigged, you know, and not in his favour. One last thing, one interview I didn't do with him, and my wife and I had our first child. My wife went into labour on the day I was due to go in an interview. Paul had decided he would be interviewed by the NME, but it was going to be a board meeting. Everybody had to wear suits. He wants to be interviewed by four different journalists at once, and everybody had to wear a suit and a shirt and tie, and we'd sit around a boardroom table. Anyway, I did have a suit somewhere in the back of my wardrobe, but then my wife went into labour, so I didn't. Tony Parsons went along and a few other people, I think.
Oh, so the other, so the board meeting happened.
That was Paul just trying to set the terms of the engagement in his own way, you know, for once.
I didn't know. I'm going to have to dig out and see if I can find that interview.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Early 1984.
Okay, I'll dig into that. And is there anything you'd like to know? Is there anything, like, if you could interview him now that you'd want to ask a question of?
I don't really. I don't miss interviewing people. I'm glad that I did interview all those people. But now I love the fact I can just sit back and
sit back and read it. Yeah.
And I don't have to understand it. I don't have to have theories about it. I mean, those three albums, I mentioned them before, but the three albums he brought out in pretty quick succession, they're all so different and also distinctive. You know, all you can ask him is something that's just too, it just sounds too dumb to ask. You know, you just find yourself saying, how do you do it? Which is just, it's just too dumb a question to ask. But sometimes you just got to look at people and think, how the hell do you do it? You know, it's just amazing.
Paul, thank you so much for your time. I love chatting with you. Really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
My thanks once again to Paul DeNoia for joining me on the podcast. Head to my website right now for the show notes, including Hit the Road with the Style Council. You can read all of that interview down under from the Hit magazine, plus trips to Nomis and Amsterdam with Weller as well, all in the show notes for this podcast, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Plus, you can find out details of Paul's books that I mentioned, In the City, A Celebration of London Music, plus Conversations with Paul McCartney. All the details on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Just head to the show notes for this episode. And whilst you're there, you can check out our merch in our store, our official podcast mug. And if you fancy buying a virtual coffee, you can do exactly that as well. My thanks to the following people who have done that over the past week. Mike Steer, hello to you, sir. Hi to Stephen Cartwright. Hi, Stephen. Hello to Smeg from the 829 Club. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hi to Jen. Hello, Stu Burns. Hi to Jane, the jam tarts with a heart. Hi to Nick Keane. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee as well. You can get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod, or if you fancy searching me out on Facebook or Instagram, just hit us up, search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.